Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 106 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Due to the efforts of Pat scrounging around for cases this week, despite there not being tons of oral arguments right now in the dead of summer, we have three cases again today. Pickings are somewhat limited, but three interesting cases again. And Pat and I are actually recording on Saturday night because I have to go up to Royal Oak, Michigan tomorrow, our firm headquarters, and got dragged into golf tomorrow and then our firm outing on Monday, so yay for me. The first case today is Board of Managers of Road. Yeah, you know, well, if you see my golfing and then the aches and pains I'll have by the end of Monday, that's what I'm looking forward to. But in any event, our first case today is Board of Managers of Rose Glen Condominium Association versus Harleysville Lake States Insurance from the First District, involving the same question from the insurer and insured perspectives. We'll get into that in a minute, and an interesting oral argument and case developing there. The second case is from the Fifth District, Pete versus Green. It involves sanctions against counsel, and we'll talk about that case as well. And then the third case today is from the Second District, Urso versus Team Illinois Hockey Club, Inc., which involves a youth hockey club and a player under the Illinois Human Rights Act. With that, let's turn to our first case today. As mentioned, the same question from two different perspectives. From the insurer's perspective, is an insured excused from giving notice to an insurer of a refiled lawsuit where the insurer had denied coverage with regard to the original lawsuit, had not filed a declaratory judgment action, and had not defended under reservation of rights? From the insurer's perspective, is an insurer stopped under Illinois law from asserting its policy defenses to disclaim coverage of a refiled lawsuit where it denies coverage before suit is filed, does not defend the original lawsuit, and does not file a declaratory judgment action? Counsel for the parties and Board of Managers of Rose Glen Condominiums Association versus Harleysville Lake Estates Insurance, which was heard before the Illinois Appellate Court First District recently, appear to be talking past each other in this case. Under Illinois law, an insurer is estopped from asserting its policy defenses if it neither defends under reservation nor files a declaratory judgment action and is left with its sole defense that the suit did not fall within the coverage in the first instance. In this case, the insurer did not receive notice of the refiled suit, which, as Justice Hyman said, is an entirely new action and took no action in response. Illinois does not require tender, merely actual notice of a lawsuit, which can come from any source, and in this case, the insurer did not receive such notice. The dispute relates to alleged construction defects, and the issue of whether there is coverage turns on whether there was damage to property other than the building. The two lawsuits had identical allegations. Pat, with that, tell us about oral arguments in this interesting insurance case.
Thanks, Dan. And so why don't we start with the procedural issue, which was what was latched onto by Justice Hyman. So when the lawsuit, there's a 2009 lawsuit and there's a 2011 lawsuit. But before any lawsuit was filed, the claim was denied. We're going to talk about differences between occurrences and a claim and lawsuit in a minute. So bookmark that. We'll come back to that. And we talked about 13-217 in the relationship to Eigner versus Tiernan. And if you recall, very early on in the show, Justice Hyman was on the panel in Eigner versus Tiernan in the First District that then went to the Supreme Court. And the court said, yeah, it's a new lawsuit and you have to file a new lawsuit, but we're going to exercise our supervisory authority and let the plaintiff get away with it, even though they didn't do it the right way. But the idea remains the same, and that is that it's a new lawsuit. So when there's a new lawsuit, why doesn't the insurer have a right to get notice of it? And the plaintiff pointed to two cases, one called Davis from 1980 and one from Pope, which is in the mid-aughts. And in response, the insurer pointed to three cases. Elko, which deals with the estoppel doctrine, which Dan touched on a moment ago, which is from 1999. Cincinnati versus West American from, I believe, 1998, which talks about that an insurance company has a duty to defend a lawsuit that potentially falls within coverage. When it receives actual notice of that lawsuit, it doesn't actually have to have someone ask them to defend the lawsuit. Once they have notice of a lawsuit that potentially falls within coverage, they have a duty to defend that lawsuit. And then Lavorsi versus Country Mutual, which is a case from 2006 that deals with notice of lawsuit, notice of anything, notice of occurrence, notice of lawsuit, that an insurance company has a right to have notice of such things within a reasonable time. And what a reasonable time is what the subject of Lavorsi is. I would add one more thing that they didn't bring up, and I wish they had, because I think it trumps this entire concept that the insurer was pushing, which was once the insurer denies coverage, it has no rights to any other, nothing from the insured. That simply isn't Illinois law. Under Waste Management versus International Surplus Lines from 1991, the duty of the insured to cooperate continues even when the parties have become adverse. Now, I understand cooperation is different than notice, but not by much. And it does show that the whole purpose of the cooperation clause is to prevent collusion between the insured and the plaintiff. And if you don't even get notice of a lawsuit, how are you able to evaluate the situation? Justice Walker harped on this idea, well, you guys had already denied the claim. And I think counsel for the insurer, I think, responded appropriately and said, hold it. Claim is not lawsuit. You have occurrence, and there's a requirement to receive notice of accident, occurrence, or loss. That's one thing. There's another thing that an insurance company is entitled to notice of a claim. That's, hey, your insured did something bad, you should pay us. And an insurance company can say, not so much. It's not covered, or we don't think they did it, or whatever it happens to be. And then you have lawsuit, which is a whole different requirement under the policy that an insurance company is entitled to a lawsuit. Now, for the life of me, I do not understand why somebody did not send this lawsuit to the insurance company. Had that been done, and had the insurance company then done nothing, it would have been very clear what the answer would be here. They would be stuck with comparing the allegations of the complaint to the policy, and maybe they would be right and maybe they would be wrong, but they wouldn't have this additional notice defense. It boggles my mind why plaintiff's counsel don't, as a matter of course, when they file the lawsuit, send the lawsuit to the alleged at-fault tortfeasor's insurance company. I had a conversation with a lawyer several weeks ago. I said, why didn't you just send the lawsuit to my client? They didn't know it had even occurred. Why would I do that? That doesn't count for service. Right. I said, it's nothing to do with service. Now there are states where sending it to the insurance company does constitute service. New Jersey is such a state, but that's not Illinois. Emphatically not Illinois. That's been tried. It doesn't work. But the idea is you've got to, why wouldn't you want the insurance company to know? Because they're going to have to do something about it. They can't just do nothing. They have to do something. If they do nothing, that's at their own peril. And the peril is what happened here. Is there now, maybe they would have done the same thing. Send out a denial letter, not defended, not filed a declaratory judgment action. I can understand why they wouldn't want to do that, because it'd be extraordinarily expensive to defend these cases. Construction defect cases
way are expensive. Really a lot of experts.
There are multiple parties. The experts, right. They're really expensive to defend. I've been involved in them on both ends. I represented construction defendants, who are trying to get coverage. And I'll never forget years ago, we had a plaintiff who we were trying to get this thing within coverage. And we said to him, can you just plead that some piece of carpet, some piece of furniture was damaged that isn't the building? Well, the common elements got damaged. Yeah, we get that. That doesn't help us get coverage. Will you please, a stained carpet, a damaged wallpaper, something, please, so you can, so we can make this, get this within coverage and get this case resolved. Because you keep talking about damage to the building, and that's not helping us. And that's the situation here, is that the question is, how did they plead it in such a fashion that there was some damage other than to the property itself? Because there's no coverage for damage to the property itself. There has to be damage to something else in order for there to be coverage under Illinois law. We didn't get a real good view from the oral argument of what the particular damage was that was being claimed. But that's the usual fight, is did they allege something other than damage to the building itself that what the general contractor built? Because there really isn't, there's no coverage for that. That's just damage to your, to the property you're working on. That's specifically not within coverage. But if there is some other property, it's usually water infiltration that got damaged, some personal property that was damaged, then you can, then you're in a lock. So this is a very interesting case, because if the court says that an insurance company is excused or not excused in a situation where they deny coverage and then don't do anything and then don't get notice of a subsequently filed lawsuit after the initial lawsuit is voluntarily dismissed, that's a much different world we're in. And I'll say Justice Walker said explicitly he thought it was a very close case. Justice Hyman didn't seem to think it was a close case at all, at least based upon his questioning and his usual I don't want to use the word combativeness, right, but aggressive questioning, we'll say, with the advocate for the insured. And so we'll see. Dan, your thoughts or anything to add on this
particular argument? I think you hit it. And yeah, I think Justice Hyman, who's a friend of both of ours, and I've known him forever, like you said, he's direct would be one word as well, but confrontational. Yeah, and again, it's confrontational only to the extent that you're trying to sell him something he's not buying, because he's
not inappropriately confrontational. But he's gonna make clear, you know where he stands usually, and you're gonna have to do some convincing to knock him back on his heels. And
you have to have the goods, and it has to be something where he's well prepared. I mean, I've known him forever. When he was a practicing lawyer, well prepared. Like you said, Pat, these cases are very expensive. I did a construction cost overrun and somewhat of a defect case when State Farm built their new location down in the Bloomington area back in the early 1990s when I first started at Lord Bissell and Brook. And we had all the contractors in the room talking about coverage. The State Farm attorneys came in at that time and put like what they're going to put on the table. And it was almost like WrestleMania between all the various trades and the lawyers arguing about whose fault it was and finger pointing. And, you know,
I've been in similar rooms, maybe not as much money at stake, but similar rooms involving condominium association, like the one here. And I remember there might've been some voices raised at lawyers on the other side of the table and claims adjusters on the other side of the table, right, going, you need to pay, and this is the people that are on the same side of things. You need to pay. No, you need to pay.
So
yeah, there's a lot of that. And in that particular situation, I said, we have made a giant offer. You haven't put anything. How about you match what we've done? Maybe we get somewhere and get this case resolved. My clients actually put money.
Now, the only other thing I'll say on this is that, like you said, I never understand why you don't tender to the insurance company for a lot of reasons, right? I mean, in most of these cases, if there's going to be a recovery, no matter what kind of case it is for the plaintiffs, there's going to be insurance money that's going to come to the table, because most people don't have the money to pay it. And then from the insurer side, it's not.
Well there's a bankruptcy in this case, too.
Right.
So they really don't have the money.
And, you know, from the insurer perspective, usually they do something, as you and I both know. They either issue a letter or a denial or do something. Just because, again, they want to make sure they protect their rights, right? They don't want to go naked and just get a letter and just put it in the file and just hope it goes away, because that's probably they have the least leverage in those cases, unless they're absolutely right. So, interesting case.
Indeed. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Pete versus Green. We're back for segment two of episode 106 of the Podium and Panel podcast. And is it an abuse of discretion for an Illinois circuit court to award only $3,500 as a sanction under Rule 137? That is Illinois' version of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 11. When the defendant incurred $74,000, or is it $94,000, a little clear, unclear from the oral argument, in fees and costs defending a frivolous claim. Does a party seeking sanctions under Rule 137 have to provide detailed time entries to collect on its fees? Those are among the questions the Illinois Appellate Court 5th District will address when it decides Keith versus Green. The plaintiff sued under a statute that appears to have been repealed, and after 3.5 years of litigation, the case was dismissed. The defendant moved for sanctions under Rule 137, and the circuit court found the case was without merit from the outset of the case. Initially, the defendant submitted a sanctions motion supported by a mere affidavit claiming $74,000 in fees without any additional detail. Subsequently, the defendant submitted an itemized statement. Notwithstanding that, the court awarded only $3,500 in fees, finding that the typical sanction in the county was no more than $5,000. Dan, why don't you tell us
about that? Sure, Pat. I want to start off with, you mentioned Rule 137. And so 137A, for those that don't know, talks about the signature of an attorney or party. Constitutes a certificate by him or her that he has read the pleading, motion, or other document to the best of his knowledge, information, and belief formed after reasonable inquiry. It is well-grounded in fact and is warranted by existing law or a good faith argument for the extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, and that it is not interposed for any improper purpose, such as to harass or to cause unnecessary delay or needless increase in the cost of litigation. There's issues if it's not signed. But if it's signed, if the document is signed in violation of this rule, the court, upon motion or upon its own initiative, may impose upon the person who signed it, a representative party or both, an appropriate sanction, which may include an order to pay to the other party or parties the amount of reasonable expenses incurred because of the filing of the pleading, motion, or other document, including a reasonable attorney fee. And so that's what's at stake here. Appellant here was arguing that the written order for sanctions, there was an action initiated by a verified complaint that was neither warranted nor well-grounded, that there was no adequate injury. As you mentioned, Pat, the initial affidavit of counsel for the plaintiffs or defendants in this case filed a one-liner, very similar to what used to be filed to Lloyd's of London back in the days by various insurance defense firms and coverage firms that have two lines, attorney's fees, $500,000, costs and expenses, $50,000, and somebody over at the Lloyd's box in London after coming back from lunch would sign off on these documentations. One of the things that the justices were asking about And there was a lot of discussion about there was a finding by the trial court in this case that the defendants had some duplicity of filings. They filed several motions to dismiss. There was at least one amended complaint, I think, that was filed in this case. The issue that really didn't come out.
When you say duplicity, you mean
the advocates use the word duplicity. But it should be duplicative. I agree. But that's what he used and what I wrote down from the oral argument. I know. I'm not accusing anybody of inappropriate conduct.
I know you're not. I know.
So I mentioned what the rule says, and it talks about a motion or filing. What was not really ferreted out, I don't think, by the advocates or by the justices' questions in this case, is that the $74,000 seems to be the entire attorney's fees that were incurred in defending this action from the beginning. Pat, as you said, the statute had been repealed. There was some statements by the counsel for the defendants. For the plaintiffs, that there were some facts that might have related back, related back and then still brought it in. There seems to have been a concession, though, in principle, that the plaintiff agreed that this statute had been repealed. Why this case went on for 4.5 years, I don't know. But like I said, one of the confusing things as I listened to oral argument and tried to decipher this is that the fees, seem to be for the entire defense of this action. And Rule 137 seems to be talking about specific pleadings, motions, or filings. And so it wasn't clear from the motion or from the sanctions whether they were pinpointing to those specific filings that were made. It's just hard to tell.
Oh, no, I think the circuit judge just made it up.
Yeah.
I think that was part of the problem, is it was a fan. Right. That's why that was the argument that it was an abuse of discretion.
Yeah.
That the $3,500 wasn't based on
it doesn't seem to be tied to anything. And then there was a second affidavit. A lot of time was spent. And again, I don't understand really the significance or relevance of it, of the timing of when the motions for were filed with the court. They were filed on a Thursday or Friday. The opposing counsel alleged he didn't get the pleadings. And then he had to work all weekend. He filed something on Sunday, and then hearings were on Tuesday. Nobody for the defendants or some counsel showed up for one of the attorneys, but they weren't there. There was questions about whether or not if they'd been there, if that would have been a different outcome for this amount. Like I said, Pat, the real issue here, it comes down to, you know, I don't know what the trial court used for the $3,500, other than there seems to have been some reference to the fact that in St. Clair County, that's kind of the range of what's awarded for sanctions, and that's, you know, $3,000 to $5,000. This case, and it seems to me to be a mess in many instances, because again, even when they filed the timesheets in the second affidavit, which again, there was debate between plaintiff and defense counsel about whether or not that was in front of the judge and in the file when he actually ruled on this thing. But it's again, unclear what that looks like. It sounds like from the briefing below and at the appellate level that there's not really a good case law that's right on point for this type of a case. And so it's just to me, listening to this oral argument, I was hoping that the Justice Barberis and the other justices would have asked more. The other thing in this court, unlike the first district that we talk about with Justice Hyman and some other appellate panels, I marked down that the appellant in this case spoke for more than 18 minutes before, 11 minutes before any justice asked any question. And then the appellee didn't speak for very long. The appellee got up and said, you know, I don't really have much to tell you. One of the interesting questions, Pat, that I thought was very interesting is that they were probing the appellee for what happens if we don't agree with the $3,500. We send it back and put him in a real difficult position, because I think he's satisfied that $3,500, right? I mean, it's a bargain, right? Right.
Yeah, he's like, we'll pay that.
And the justices kept saying, well, what happens if it goes back? Do you want another evidentiary hearing? He's like, another evidentiary hearing? No, I don't want a second evidentiary hearing, because, you know, nobody gets a second evidentiary hearing on this type of thing, right? That you get one and done. So it'll be interesting to see what this panel does with this case. $3,500 seems low given again, this case went on for 4.5 years. One of the statements that was or comments, I forget if it was in reaction to a question, but it was that if you Googled this matter, you would have been able to find instantly that there was no cause of action available for this matter. So, again, we as attorneys have some obligation to actually, you know, do some homework and not just file lawsuits that are frivolous or without basis. So, Pat, you have anything out of this?
Well, that's true. And but once you get it pointed out to you that, hey, this thing's been repealed, you better either be able to say, no, the action occurred before it got repealed, or why not dismiss it? Which is why I think they might be entitled to get the full amount of the fees that they expended, because the entire exercise was occasioned by a claim based on a statute that wasn't enforced.
As I read in Rule 137, it also talks about extension of law. I mean, again, we as lawyers, sometimes that's what you have, right? But you have to have a good faith basis. If a statute's repealed and there's nothing to replace it, then I don't know what you really can say with the extension of what, right? It's gone.
There was recently a case, last fall, one of my former partners was arguing a case, and someone's like, he just lost this very same case in another case. You should sanction him. And they sought sanctions under appellate rule, or under Rule 375, which is the bringing in a frivolous appeal. And the court said, no, you don't get to sanction someone for asking for the law to be changed. He acknowledged that he had lost the case not so long ago, very similar one, perhaps factually similar or identical. And he's saying that was wrong and you should ignore it and you should decide this in my favor. The court's like, how else does the law develop? No. So you have to be able to do that. But that's not the situation here. He had a statutory cause of action, apparently, and the statute went away. So, no, that's not your plea is to the General Assembly.
Right.
Not to
the other thing I'll say about a case like this, and we've talked about this before, I think, Pat, on the podcast, is that judges in general are very resistant, I think I would use that word, to issuing significant sanctions against a party or against lawyers. It happens, but you and I have talked about sometimes where things are filed and again it gets into a mess like this, and again at the federal level, at the state level, judges are just very hesitant, I think, to overly punish.
I would use the word loathe.
That's a good word for it. That hits it on the head.
It does. All right. So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with Urso versus Team Illinois Hockey Club, Inc.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiuminpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 106 with our third case today, Urso. In this case, the question is, a private elite level youth hockey club that conducts its practices at a privately held facility open to the public, subject to Section 5 of the Illinois Human Rights Act, when it prevents an otherwise qualified player with a mental health condition from participating? That is essentially the question to be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court, 2nd District, decides Urso versus Team Illinois Hockey Club, Inc. The coach of the team allegedly aided and abetted by another forbade a player from participating in team activities when they were advised that the player had a mental health condition and required a doctor's note before they would allow her to participate. The player and parents filed a charge with the Illinois Human Rights Commission, which found insufficient evidence, and then filed a claim in court, which was dismissed. On appeal, there was a lot of discussion of the Martin versus PGA case from the Supreme Court of the United States and whether the 2000 amendments and the Illinois Human Rights Act expanded the scope of protection. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this case.
Thanks, Dan. So we talk about this a fair amount on the show, but I think this is a very important in the review of this case, and that is the standard of review. Standard of review here is de novo. This is on a motion to dismiss. And it's important that that be kept in mind, because this is a case that was originally submitted to the Illinois Human Rights Commission, which found it was unclear whether they found they didn't have subject matter jurisdiction or if there was insufficient evidence. One thing that's important also to note is they didn't identify the mental health condition that this young woman had, but they did give her name, which I found really bizarre. This was not filed as, you know, MU. They disclosed her name during the oral argument. They gave her first name. Right. Obviously, we have her last name. It's in the caption. And it was like, what the? Not only is she a minor, but she's allegedly a minor with a mental health condition. I was very surprised that that's how this case was captioned. It was done in her name. One of the issues is whether this is a place of public accommodation. Now, the team has like a fixed area they're allowed to use at this hockey arena that's in the suburbs, but they don't own the facility itself. So is it a place of a public accommodation? And frankly, what counsel for the appellant says, it doesn't matter if it's a place of public accommodation. It doesn't matter how much they can control it, which counsel for the appellee said, hold it, we only control it when we are exercising our lease to use certain aspects of the hockey, of the ice, you know, this whole facility. It's got all kinds of other things she can go use. She just can't participate in our activities. And the appellant kind of tried to poo-poo that argument. We'll see if that works. But there's not much of an argument that the club is a person under the statute. Illinois provides a broad protection under its Human Rights Act for a wide variety of claims that are, yes, like EEOC and like certain federal statutes, but not identical. And they're usually broader in protections. It's hard to understand what happened here is the mother of the player went to the coach and gave him a note or expressed that she was going to have difficulty in participating for one reason or another. And then they required 100% participation absent a note from a doctor that said that she was able to participate. The case that they kept coming back to is the Martin versus PGA case. And for those that don't remember, Casey Martin was a professional golfer who had a circulatory condition in one of his legs that made it difficult, if not impossible, or at least very painful for him to walk 18 holes. Dan doesn't have a circulatory problem, but he's going to have a hard time walking 18 holes. Anyway, this guy has this congenital condition that he was talented enough to play, but he wanted to use a cart. And under the Americans with Disabilities Act, he sought an accommodation to be allowed to drive a cart. And the players are like, no, you can't do that. That changes the game. Walking the course is part of the game. And the court said, no, this is at the highest level of the sport. You know, it's selective. It's as selective as it gets. The highest level of that particular sport. And yes, he gets to drive a cart in order to be able to participate. And yes, it might take away from some aspect of the game, but it's a reasonable accommodation that has to be allowed. Now, I didn't like that decision now, and I don't like that. I didn't like it then, and I don't like it now. But that's the law, and because I think it does change the game, and it is part of the game. Are we gonna give a cart to the basketball player that's got to get up and down the floor because he can't run up and down the floor? I mean, that running happens to be part of the game. I'm not sure. But anyway, the idea here, though, the reason why that case is important is because you don't get to hide behind the idea that this is an elite club and you have to be able to otherwise. She was otherwise able to participate. She just had some limitation we don't know what dimension it was, some limitation. So I'd be very interested to learn some more about the facts of this. I'll be interested to see how much of the facts they can disclose about this. Dan, anything else? What are your thoughts
on this? I agree with you.
Except the part about Martin versus.
Yeah, with golf, I mean, the absurdity of it, it'd be like saying that you're a hiker, but you have somebody else carrying your backpack, because that's what happens when people walk the course anyway. When Tiger Woods or others, they walk and stroll, and some schlep in 100 degree temperatures is carrying their 18 clubs and their balls and, you know, go shagging shit. So,
well, they better not have 18. They better not have more than 14.
But I agree with you. I mean, it's, you know, to me, it's like a lot of sports and games, it's kind of, you know, the old fashioned rules, right? It's probably it was walking, because think about when golf started, you know, over in Scotland and stuff, there were no carts, you know, so right.
No carts. You were on your own.
Right.
And there were no caddies either. You were carrying your own bag, I suspect.
But in any event, and again, it's interesting to keep you, they kept coming back to that case, because that case involves a physical disability, right, that we're talking about. This one, like you said, quite unclear clear, what yeah. the mental health is. We don't need to know it, but odd that they have the name of the individual. I thought that was odd as well. You know, that typically in these cases, you have either a last initial or a Jane Doe or something, just because to protect them, a minor. So yeah. Very, very peculiar.
Yeah. And now you're dealing with a minor with a mental health condition. I just don't understand it. Maybe she's a major.
That's what I was saying, but it's again, it's unclear. So who knows?
So with that brings us to our business interruption for COVID cases for the week. Dan, why don't you tell us about
that? There's a state court or two held for insurers, one which was in California, which seems to create a split in their appellate courts at least. And so we'll see what happens, at least in California. Other than that, at the federal, that could be because it's after the 4th of July. But the other thing that could be happening, especially at the Circuit Courts of Appeal at the federal level, is that we've talked about extensive decisions after decisions, and so it seems like they've cleaned out the any of that kind of backlog, right? That I'm not aware of a lot of cases still pending at the courts of appeals around the country. So,
yeah, I'm not sure where that stands. Which brings us to our predictions for the week. We are now 160.5, 28.5, and 10. We had appellant versus appellee that we covered all the way back on episode 22 in April of 2021. It was a long time ago. They issued that opinion day. It took them over a year to issue an opinion that's like 2.5, 3 pages. And in that, now I understand why, because it's a case where it's an enforcement of a grand jury subpoena. Grand jury subpoenas are very secretive. And this is a question of whether the subpoena was acting more like a warrant, and whether it was reasonable. And the court said, yes, you have to produce the documents, but you need to go back and go through what it called a further iterative process to determine the propriety of the extent of the request, because the search terms and extensions were getting all kinds of irrelevant stuff that didn't matter, and it was costing a lot to ferret that stuff out. So we don't know what the nature of the subpoena was in terms of who it was directed to, because apparently that would disclose what the grand jury was investigating. So that didn't get disclosed, but we kind of, so it's in generalities. An interesting case. Dan, no. Anything to add on that? All right, which brings us to NCAA versus Finnerty, which was discussed, I believe, on episode 63, which is a decision from the Indiana Supreme Court. Dan, why don't you tell us about this case that has two issues of first impression, one procedural, one substantive.
Sure. The first one is the procedural. Indiana court held that the trial court's order on a repetitive motion or a motion to reconsider is an other interlocutory order under Rule 14B, so the appeal was properly before them, which again, it was an open question.
Yeah. So let me stop there.
It is.
This is important. So this in Indiana, you can get interlocutory review of any order without like a certification of a question. You can get a certification of an order and then discretion in the appellate court whether to take the case or not. And in this case, there is a trial rule, which is distinct from appellate rule. There's a trial rule that prevents you from bringing repetitive motions. And the court's like, so what? That's a trial rule. That doesn't limit the jurisdiction of the appellate court to hear an order, because the original order in this case wasn't heard, or what the original motion for certification didn't get ruled on in time. And pursuant to the rule, If it's not ruled on within 30 days, it's denied. It's denied as a matter of course. And so now they had to refile it. They beefed it up a little bit. They filed a new one, and the court said, the plaintiffs argued, well, that's just a repetitive motion. You can't do that either. And the court said, no, that's not how this works. We're going to get to the merits. So we'll tell us about the merits.
They reviewed the apex doctrine that has to do with executives and being able to depose them and all that kind of stuff. They declined to adopt the apex doctrine. Instead, they established a framework that harmonizes its underlying principles with their applicable trial rules to assist courts in determining whether good cause exists to limit or prohibit the deposition of a top-level official in a large organization. And so they remanded for the trial court to evaluate the NCAA's second motion for a protective order with the benefit of this guidance. So tell us a little more about the apex doctrine, Pat.
So this is a case. This case arises out of the concussion litigation against the NCAA, and they wanted to pose Mark Emmert, and they wanted to pose the chief medical officer, and I think another executive,
right,
chief legal officer of the NCAA. And given the number of multi-district litigation and class actions around the country, these guys would spend their entire lives in deposition if there weren't some limitations. So that's the argument the NCAA has made, and why they fought so hard to prevent them. These fellows from being deposed repeatedly. But we'll see if it works. One of the arguments that the plaintiffs made is that Emmert is in particular a witness that has unique knowledge, which is one of the standards for deposing someone. The reason why he does is because he's the first head of the NCAA who, right, also was a college president. He was president of Washington University in St. Louis, which, though not a football power, yeah, does have football. He has certain knowledge as to what college presidents knew or were told about this at a time when at least one of the players involved was one of the plaintiffs in this case was playing, one of the named plaintiffs. This is a putative class action. So a very interesting and important case on the apex doctrine. Which brings us to the rule of the week, Dan. This is one you found. So tell us
about this. Wait, before we do that, we have to predictions for this week.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I have to pick this week. Oh, sure.
Rose Glenn.
Yeah, good point.
I think affirmed.
Affirmed. Justice Walker may dissent. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens there. Pete versus Green.
It's getting reversed. I don't know what's going to happen when it comes back up, but it's getting reversed. Right.
I think they'll probably remand it, but it's got to get reversed,
right,
to have it at a hearing.
I agree. I can't see this being upheld.
And I think Urso is getting reversed because I think they want more information. I don't think they're going to – I think they're going to say this is a motion to dismiss stage.
Yep, I agree.
We need more.
Sure.
Now tell us about the rule.
It has to do with GVR, which we'll define in a minute. Welcome to the SCOTUS jungle. So the rule of the week comes to us from Adam Feldman, who is brilliant in his deep analysis on the work of the court and who you should follow if you're not. He is Empirical SCOTUS. It can be found on LinkedIn. He also can be found on SCOTUS blog often. He's written articles, I think, for the Chicago Bar record as well. I think at one time or another he's written some of these statistical things. But in any event, he's really brilliant. And he wrote about what happens at the end of the Supreme Court term. He said, you might not have been aware, but one of the busiest days in the Supreme Court term occurs after all orally argued cases are decided. And we've talked about some of those cases on here, Pat, in the past few weeks. Then at the end of each Supreme Court term, the court has to close out many cases that deal with similar issues to cases that the court adjudicated throughout the term and usually at the end of the term. So he then listed the cases that were disposed of as well as the decisions that led to these dispositions. Each of these cases was decided on a GVR or granted, vacated, and remanded basis on the case argued before the Supreme Court. And so there's a number of cases that were granted, vacated, and remanded based on Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, some based on Ruan versus United States, several that were based on the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. versus Bruin, and then some other cases based on the Native American case, Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta, and some on Concepcion versus United. And so this happens every year. And the reason for it is because these are cases that were pending before the court. They hadn't really issued oral arguments. But because the cases have been decided, whatever the underlying issues are, they're remanded back to the courts to handle them in accordance with those cases.
Right. Basically, we've decided the issue. Yeah, we've decided the issue. Now decide the case based upon what we decided, and maybe we'll take a look at it again if you can find a reason
right.
why you shouldn't
follow.
And
that happens sometimes. You'll see cases that go down and come back up for that very reason, Pat.
The other option that might happen, and this may not have happened because of timing, is they might have been consolidated into. You oftentimes hear when Chief Justice Roberts introduces a case, he'll say, you know, Smith versus Jones and the consolidated case or cases. He'll say, because they just take a whole bunch of cases, they jam them together. And these may have been situations where either a motion to consolidate was denied, or the case came up too late to consolidate, or it, you know, whatever it happens to be. But they realize that deciding, you know, Dobbs versus Jackson deals with a whole bunch of other cases that are challenging other abortion restrictions, or the gun cases. They're deciding, you know, the six states that had these may issue situations. You know, the ruling in Bruin affects what happens in New Jersey and Hawaii and California and so forth.
Yeah, a great instance of the consolidation you're talking about is Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. It consolidated, I think, four or five cases at various state levels, including an Arkansas case and some other cases. And then there was a second decision that had to do with the
Because Brown arose
out
of Topeka,
and then there
Kansas.
Was a separate case that was at the federal level in D.C. because D.C. is like with Heller, D.C. is its own. It's overseen by Congress. It's a federal jurisdiction, and so that does happen. Like you said, Pat, a lot of times what happens is these cases come in too late, you know, and so their petitions are filed. Sometimes people, I think, try to get them under the wire so they'll be consolidated, like you said. But it sometimes the timing's off, or for whatever reason, it's too unwieldy, or something's already, it's already been granted oral argument, and so you already have the advocates. We've talked about that as well, about the advocates fighting over who, you know, gets the straw to argue, and sometimes it's unusual players. So at any event, interesting rule of the week. And like I said, if you're not following Adam Feldman, as we often do on the show, when we see people that are really doing interesting stuff on LinkedIn and out there with various kinds of useful information, we provide names and suggest you follow them.
Indeed. So with that, appreciate everybody joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.